Going on to school, and I remember one time at my father's birthday, we were home, we had a big celebration, it was his 71st birthday. And my mother had died a number of years before the woman died when I was 21. And so we had all these people, oh my goodness, there must have been over 100 people for my dad's birthday, and headed outside, you know, at my dad's house. And one of the men came up to me, one of my dad's cousins, said, "Well, what are you doing?" And I said, "Oh, I'm going to school to get my degree." "You're still going to school? Aren't you too old? Maybe what you better do is just come home and make baskets, and then you won't keep going to school." And I thought, you know, maybe he has something. I think it's very difficult, and I never, ever question anybody who stays there. Why don't they want to go on? Why don't they want to do this? Why don't they want to do that? Because maybe it's much more comforting and much more what they want to do with their lives. My brother has 4 children, and 2 of them are on the rest and 2 of them are off. And the ones who are on the res are very content, very happy. They were. They were living a very good life. And it's just much more tradition.
Yeah. So when you graduated from high school, what did you do then?
We had a 1-year school called Normal School, teaching college for 1 year. I went to that, and then I went back to the res to teach.
And when you went back to the res, what did you teach?
I taught elementary school, all grades, 1 through 8, 43 kids.
What was that like to go back and become the role model?
Oh, I loved it. I loved the kids. As I said, I loved the teaching. And I loved the kids. And I think I did a good job. I threw my whole heart and soul into teaching. I met a non-Indian and fell in love and got married and left.
We'll back up just a little bit. Did you have any while you were on the reservation after high school, did you have any political activities outside of the reservation?
No, I became much more active in the educational component.
Mm-hmm.
We tried to get a PTA going, and we wanted to get more parent involvement. We had a teacher's organization. I was much more involved in that.
Were your schools well funded?
No.
So, was that a constant?
Yeah, we were trying to get more materials for our schools. We were trying to get more involvement. We were trying to get parents to understand more about the children's education. There were many things that we... And I remember one time we went to a one-day conference on it was on the Kettle Point Indian Reserve. And when we stood up to introduce ourselves, we were the only Indian teachers of Indian day schools. It was a conference of Indian day school teachers. And it was just amazing to me that how we all stood up and introduced ourselves, and we were the only Indians. All the other teachers of Indian day schools on other reserves in Ontario were all white. Yeah, and so there was something in our reserve, and it still is today, that tries to bring the people back to help and to stay within the community.
At that conference, were you as valued? Do you find that you were considered equal?
Well, we outnumbered, mm-hmm. And so, you know, it was just kind of a contrast, because we were teaching our own,
mm-hmm.
And these people were coming from the outside, so they had questions about us.
Was your curriculum dictated by?
By the province of Ontario.
Mm-hmm. So it was very much structured.
Yeah, it was Spot and Dick and Jane and Baby Sally and Puff and...
Were you allowed to teach anything traditional?
We did. We worked that in. And I did not even introduce Dick and Jane books to my first grade class until well into the year. We wrote our own little things. That's what I suppose that's my introduction to what we now call mediated learning. I did it at that time. For instance, I had my little boy who didn't speak any English into grade one. And so my Indian was starting to come back. He was a Cuba speaker. Because I came home and asked my dad, I said, now I have to tell Jacob this, but how do I say that? So I was getting back into the language. And we would write our own stories. And about my name is Jacob, or my name is Benjamin. I had a Benjamin. And several others in him. You know, I live on Six Nations. You learn all these things. So halfway through the year, I then introduced Spot and Dick and Jane to this valley because when the inspector came in, they had to be those books.
So they were coming to you native speaking.
Yeah.
So you were incorporating.
Yeah.
Essentially.
Yeah, their lifestyle.
Yeah. Yeah. So you were teaching them English along with all of their other skills.
Yeah. Yeah. Uh-huh. But since I was from there, it was easy for me to do that because I understood.
Yeah. Yeah. How did the kids react?
Oh, they loved it. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. And I'll never forget one day when the boys came up to me and he says, teacher. He says, you're not telling us to stop. I said, stop? What are you doing? And I knew right then and there what he was talking about. He says, you know. I said, no, I don't know. Tell him. He says, you know, talk in Indian. I said, oh. He says, when we come through that gate, we're not supposed to talk Indian. I said, really? And I knew it, because that's how I went to school. Mm-hmm. I said, well, I'll tell you what, I'll make a deal with you. You can talk Indian during lunch hour and recess. But when Mr. Hill, the principal, walks through the gate, please talk English. They laughed and they loved it. They just loved it. And then one little boy came up to me one day, teacher. I said, yeah. He says, you talk Indian, don't you? I said, no, not really, just a little bit. Yes, you do, too, because your dad doesn't even talk English. Because my dad would never talk English to the little kids who talked Indian. Yeah, I'll talk Indian. And so I said, no, but I'm learning. And he was so cute. So, you know, they were comfortable with that.
They were aware that they in order to do what needed to be done.
Oh, yeah. I never had any problem. Mr. Hill came to all talk English.
When you were a child, were there severe punishments?
Well, yes. Yes, there were severe punishments for speaking. Yeah.
It's like what?
Rat crafts with your knuckles. Yeah. And being yelled at. Being made to sit back over there.
And you had Indian teachers?
I had Indian teachers. But that's that whole assimilation model that came through. Now that's not the case. Now they're doing language immersion.
Yeah.
And I said, we could have had language immersion before because most of us came to school from Indian-speaking homes. It's weird when you look at, you know, what goes on.
How it goes around.
How it goes around. And my brother and I were laughing at the and I was sitting there and I said something. I said to my brother, isn't that how you say that? And he said, I don't know. And his granddaughter was sitting there, and she said, no, Grandpa, that's not. Both of you are wrong. She's in language immersion. I said, now, okay, now here we are. We're coming back down to our third generation now here learning the language. This is wonderful. I love it.
She's making sure you remember.
She's making sure we, and we did it correctly.
Oh, wow. It's funny where it comes from.
Isn't it, though? And how education gets, you know, so much a part of society and picking on the values of society at large rather than looking at the values of the groups that we're working with. You know, the same thing I was thinking, there's a whole big hullabaloo over the Ebonics.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, and I can't see the hullabaloo. And that's how the children talk. That's how they talk. You can teach English from using it. It's the base. It's all they're talking about in Ebonics. And my God, the whole education system practically crashed over Ebonics, you know, and why are we doing that? And blah, 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 and that's not English. No, it's not proper English. But I think so many of the African American teachers have pointed that out. That's their role, is to teach proper English. And when they go back to their community, they can talk, you know, either way. And that's our role. That's our role in education, as far as I'm concerned. Not to say, oh, this is bad, this is no good. I mean, that's how I was raised. It's not what you do. So therefore, what does that do to kids? Because my parents were being all the time in the house. I'm supposed to think this is negative and bad. I shouldn't do this.
Did you?
No, I didn't. No, I never really ever did.
Did there ever come a point in your adolescence or teenage years where you almost felt ashamed?
No, no. I must honestly say I never did. I never felt ashamed of being Indian. And I get very angry at people who try to pass. I remember one time, it was his family who grew up in the village. He cooked, we had a Royal Canadian Mounted Police barracks, relative in our village, because we didn't come under the local jurisdiction. And the cook for the barracks, for the Mounties, was a white man, and he had a wife and a daughter who lived in the village. Well, I became very good friends with her. And actually, right up until about 5 or 6 years ago, I haven't seen her since for about 5 or 6 years, but we stayed friends all these years. And her mother joined the Indian Women's Club and had a lot of good friends. And then they moved away. They moved away to a town not too far away. So she'd come out to visit. She'd come out to spend weekends with us. Yeah, she was a part of it. She went to school in the village. She was really part of Indian culture. And one day she had come up for the Indian Fair. One weekend she had come up for the Indian Fair. And we were all, as you know, adolescent girls, 15 or 16, arm in arm, strolling around, you know, midway and that kind of thing. So she met this girl. And she said, oh, what are you doing here? She said, oh, I just came out to see them. I was standing here with the other girl. There were three of us, there were two of us in our bunch. And so when she finished talking to her, she left. And I said, well, why did you ask her what she was doing here? She says, well, she said, I wondered. She says, I go to school with her. And I wondered what she was doing up here. I said, oh, for goodness sake, said Zelda Herkimer, for down on fourth line. She's an Indian. That upset my friend so much. She said, how dare she not say she's Indian? She kept saying she was French. And that was the first time I had ever been confronted with somebody really doing that, trying not to be Indian.
Interesting.
Yeah, and I get really, I was really angry about it, and Marge was really angry about it, because her parents had so many good friends on her, they had so many good friends who were Indians there. She also took pretty good friends to that. But that was the first time I had really been confronted with somebody, and I could really then see the embarrassment that Zelda had, because she was caught.
Mm.
She didn't realize that Marge used to come to her friends all the time.
Yeah.
But that was an interesting that sticks out in my mind. I can still even see it today.
And how do you feel about way to ask it. Do you still get as angry? People that you know?
No, I don't. I sort of feel they've done it for whatever their reason is.
More taller.
Oh, yes, I'm a lot more taller. I'm not so. They have reasons to do for what they do. They're hurt in life or whatever they did. I very fortunately, I think, grew up in a family that was proud of being Indian. And I think my experience with my mom was similar. All my growing up, I was not ever ashamed or embarrassed. And I remember even one time, my first husband,
was an academic, and we were at Princeton University. We wrote for social media. But this one anthropologist was talking about her research. And I sit there and I listen. All of a sudden, she is talking about my home and she's got it called mom. She's looking at it from, what she was doing was looking at why the Indians didn't use the Indian hospital. And she had all these reasons, you know, our superstitions and our this and our that. And I said, you know, I grew up here, and I didn't leave, and this had been maybe about 6 or 7 years after I got here. So I said, only until about 7 years ago, and I'm back here with the summer for 2 years. I said, the reason the Indians don't use the Indian hospital is the doctor is no good. Has nothing to do. I said, we can combine using the medicine man and the white man's doctor very well. We have no problem with that. I said, my own family did that all the time. I said, but that doctor doesn't do anything. And nobody's going to go there, so they're going to go to town if they're going to use the white man's doctor. And she got really upset. And I realized now, when looking back on it, I could have done it very differently with her. I could have, you know, asked, talked to her separately, something like this. But, you know, I'm engaged in this confrontation. It's a social event. But, I mean, never going out and asking the Indians, why don't you use the doctor? Why don't you use the hospital? She got it all from the doctors and the nurses' point of view, who were not Indians.
Something to assumptions.
Yes. Yes. An anthropologist? You know, I mean, I thought it was really pretty bad research.
That leads me to an interesting question about, about the combining of medicines and things like that. Right? How, when you were a small child versus as you got older, were you allowed to use a medicine man?
Yeah. My folks used a medicine man, and my folks used the white doctor. Mm-hmm. There was no question. Both were legitimate.
The reason I ask is because as I read some of the accounts of Lakota tribes and stuff, and on their reservation experiences, reservation police, and you know, there's a lot of pressure from the external community to only use white facility and not do anything related to Indian culture. Mm-hmm. So, what kind of how?
It was not that when I was growing up, and I think you know the Lakota experience is so different from mine. You've got to realize that my reserve was formed in 1784.
Very early.
Yes. Wow. So back east, we were reservationized very, very early. The Lakota fought their last Indian white war in 1890. Yeah. Over 100 years later than we were on the reserve.
So for you, your experience was very much sort of melded.
Yes. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And yet, you know, as I say to people too, when I go back home now, and I sit in the village, going for a cup of coffee, bowl of corn soup, and come on, we live in a very industrialized area. It's very close to a lot of industrialized centers. Actually, we're only about 60 miles from Toronto, Ontario, which is a large major center. It's still all there. It's good to hear the men sitting there talking our language, and that is all there. And we still use medicine. We still have medicine. I think at that point, and when I was growing up, we controlled a lot of our own. It was not like with the military and the Indian battles that the Lakota. I understand their anger a lot more because of that. You realize that was only 107 years ago. They've got to have a few hundred more years under their belt. And yet, you know, they have very traditional people, and they have strong medicine men. But they also have a lot of pressure of your immune, which we didn't have.
So for you, just speaking of that conference, it wasn't unusual. Just to sort of clarify, it wasn't unusual for you, your mother or father to call in the medicine man and then later on maybe go to the white man's doctor.
No, it was not unusual at all.
How did you've gone to the white man's doctor and he says those typical doctor questions like, well, what have you been doing for this?
Mm-hmm.
And your mother or father or you says, well, the medicine man said, how receptive to the white in your area?
I don't think they ever would have said that. I think Indians we were able to compartmentalize these things very well. I don't think they ever would have said that. I remember one time my mother had varicose vein surgery, and one broke on her ankle, ulcerated. And she treated with the doctor of Indian Hospital all summer long, and he didn't get anything. She was off her feet all summer. And in the fall, my dad finally said, I think we've gone there long enough. We've got to go see so-and-so. After about 2 months, it was all completely healed. He just used her. He would sprinkle it on her, but I give up.
And that was it?
That was it. It never broke me.
So it does sound very incorporated and very,
Yeah, I think I never really had any problems that you only do this or you only do that.
I hadn't realized that the East Coast Canadian Indian reservations had been established at the firm.
Yeah. It's a beautiful. We had our bicentennial celebration in 1984. And of course, we were all home. Both my sisters were alive at the time, and my brother and myself, and all our kids. And I said, here we are, celebrating 200 years of colonialism. I said, we'll do anything to have a celebration.
That's true. That's an interesting perspective.
You know, of course, they didn't know what I was talking about. You know, my brother did, but not my sisters. But I thought it was really kind of funny. So here we are. And I saw people I hadn't seen in 20 years. They were all there.
So everybody was there to celebrate.
Everybody was celebrating colonialism. Oh, God, being colonized. I said, we've been colonized for 200 years.
Looking for the party.
Yes. But it was great. They had a marvelous celebration, and everybody was there. And, you know, they turned it into a positive.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Made it a very, very good thing that here we are, and here's our culture, and here are our children. And it was so good to see all our little children coming out in our traditional dress, and doing the dances. And, you know, it was nice.
Definitely a celebration of culture.
Yes, it was definitely a celebration of culture. That's wonderful.
Now, let's see. Graduated high school. On the reservation. What did you say? Married a non-Indian.
Married a non-Indian.
Let's talk about that for a while. How did you meet?
Well, we just, I don't know. We were at a party and he asked me to dance. And that was it. And,
off the reservation party?
Yeah. Actually, it was when I was away at school.
Mm-hmm.
And then I'd come back to teach and I was still going with him and he would come up for the rest. And so then we got married after my first year.
How did your family feel about it?
Mixed. Well, my mother had passed away by this time, and my dad was kind of mixed about it. I think he would have been very happy for me not to leave. As I say, we Indians have this what we call the principle of non-interference. You don't interfere in anyone else's life. And it was a good period of time. I learned a lot, as I said, you know. At that point, he was a master's in mathematics, went on for his PhD. That's how I got to California. He was a professor at UCSD.
And they were, that would have been around 1950?
I got married in 1951. Yeah. And I left at that point.
But, you know, I've gone back every year. Until this past year, I didn't go back last summer. My sister, I lost my sister in May, so I didn't go back this summer. This past summer, and I guess I'll go back this summer. My kids are all on here. So.
Who still has some of those?
My brother's boys, my brother's one son and daughter, plus a lot of my friends. And so my brother, just very typical like my father. My brother retired in Florida. He's 73. And just it's been difficult to get more of his arthritic legs, which is hurting a lot. So. And so he called me about 2 weeks ago, and he says, have you made your vacation plans? I said, no. Why? He says, well, I was wondering, are you going home this summer? I said, I hadn't thought about it. I said, are you? He says, yeah, I kind of thought I'd go up around the end of July. You thinking of going?
Hint, hint.
Never come right out and say, you know, this is again very typically Indian. It's so funny. I said, when I hung up, I started to laugh. And then one of my sons called and I said, well, your uncle Buck just called. And I said, oh, God, he reminds me of our dad. And he said, and so I said, well, I don't know. I said, I'll let you know. Let me think about it. Because we didn't go that summer, neither he nor I went. We always went home that summer. My sister's birthday was in July. And we always had her big birthday party, all the family. My niece always had it at her house. So we always did that big birthday celebration. So we didn't do it last summer. So my one son called me and he says, are you going up home this summer? Because my granddaughter wants to go again. I'm thinking about that. I said, I don't know. I'm thinking about it. Something you should go. So then the other one called. Are you going up home this summer? I don't know. He said, I talked to Uncle Buddy. He wants you to go, I guess. I said, yeah, I know. And he said, well, he said, I think maybe what we should do is if we all go.
Just started planning.
They got me going. And he said, well, you know, well, what happens if we just take care of everything and you just get on the plane? So I said, okay.
Sign me up.
So I think we'll probably be going. The way this was just all been going on this week. Because my one son was talking to me, so I'm going to Florida. So.
That would be the principle of what, non-interference, is that it?
Yes.
Yeah. Inaction.
Inaction. Everybody's just kind of thinking, well, you really should go this summer, Ma. You know, you haven't been last summer, because I always went into July. Mm-hmm. So I probably will be going in July. That's the way that is.
I do want to get back to when you got married, but I definitely want to talk a little bit about your sisters and your brother. What kind of relationship did you have? You were so far apart in age.
Well, with my oldest sister, I had a very, very close relationship because she's more like a mother to me. You know, she took care of me. She never had any children of her own. So I was that child. And since my mother was so much older, I think I became her child.
So you were 20?
20 years younger than my oldest sister, yes.
And did she stay, did she live on a mission?
Oh, she did for a number of years, and then she moved to town, and then she lived in town.
She was never married?
Oh, yeah, she married, but never had any children.
Mm-hmm. Was that by choice?
No, she never could have children. Mm-hmm. She would have been a good mother, but that's the way it is with some, you know, the way it's with some.
And so you had a very close relationship with her?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then my next sister left the res when she was very young and never went back. I was not as close to her. She always kind of flitted in and out of our lives, I guess. She'd come for a little bit and then she'd leave, and then she'd come for a little bit and then she'd leave. She always had other things more important.
Was she very active in the Indian culture?
No, not at all. No, not at all. She kind of put the Indian culture aside and
Yeah. What was that like for you? Especially as you got older.
It didn't really bother me. I mean, that was sort of her line. And I didn't agree with it.
Did that keep you separate?
That probably did. Yeah, it probably was one of the reasons why we weren't so close. Mm-hmm. But I'm very close with my brother.
7 years?
Yeah.
Older?
Yeah. He and I grew up together.
Mm-hmm. He smart. Was he the proverbial older brother?
Yes, he really was. And I always remember when he first left the res and got a job, first weekend he came home, he brought me this watch.
And how old were you when that happened?
10.
Had you ever seen one before?
I'd seen a watch, but I'd never had one. And then the next time he came home, he brought me a new dress.
So you were like a new set of
films. Yes, he was. He was. And still, we're still very close, yeah.
And he is very active in the Indian culture?
He was. He's moved to Florida, but he goes home quite a bit.
Yeah. Obviously, his children still live there?
Yeah, yes, yeah. Well, he lived there for a long time. He left and moved to Florida about. That's so long ago, I can't remember. But he lived on the reservation.
What did he do for work?
He worked in Niagara Falls. He was a laborer. And then two of his boys are iron workers, are traditional iron workers from back there. And one lives in Dallas, Texas, and one lives in Florida. There are iron workers there. Mm-hmm. And then the two live on the res.
So he has four children?
Four children.
Wow.
So, I think he and I, as I said, are closer because we're the two younger ones.
And sort of took care of you.
Yeah, he took care of me. Oh, yes, he always did.
Well, you were the youngest in the family. What kind of I just was backtracking a little bit. What kind of jobs did you have around the house?
Oh, I could do lots of work around the house. I had to work in the fields. Mm-hmm. My dad was, as I said, farmer. Mm-hmm. I had to hoe and I had to weed and I had to pick strawberries. We threw strawberries for sale. Then in the house, I had to clean. My mother was a very good housekeeper, even though we didn't have very much. My mother liked things clean. Mm-hmm. So I can't even remember. God, I don't do that in my own house. cleaning all the chair legs and rungs every Saturday. I had to do all of that.
Was the work, did you find that you were doing most of the work because you were the last one there?
No, I think that was, everybody had to do those things. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And even when my mother was very sick, I said that one summer she was in the hospital part of the time. My brother did it. Yeah.
So it wasn't gender related?
No, it was not gender related at all. Uh-uh. I told him one day when we were up home, I said, oh, you used to make the best popovers. And he did make the best popovers. I can't make popovers. Mine go plug. It was nice and puffy, and then he used to make blancmange.
Wow. Quite the chef.
Yes, and we just laugh because you just have to do what you have to do.
To get that.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Did your dad do anything like that?
Oh, yes. My dad cooked. Oh, yes.
So that's, yeah. That's is that usual for an Indian family?
Up there it is.
Up there?
Yeah. And you get some of your Lakotas and your Western friends. No, those men don't want to do anything. They don't want to be waited on hand and foot. I said, no way at our place, no. Because when my mother was sick, my dad would fix breakfast. No. I grew up in a household like that.
Okay, well, we'll move a little bit forward again because I do want to hear about your marriage.
Yeah.
So you said you're married once?
Yeah, with my second marriage. Yeah. He's my present husband. I've been married.
So, but the first husband was the Princeton, and then the...
Yeah, he was the academic.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so you married, and then your family was a little mixed.
What about
his?
I don't know. His family, his mother was... They were very well-educated people. His mother was a PhD. They treated me just beautifully. They were just wonderful. They were wonderful. And so it was a good relationship there. We just kind of grew apart. When he married me, I was a wide, starry-eyed Indian from the res, didn't know very much. And as I got to be going to college and learning more and more, exercise and get you to be very active. He didn't like that. Woman's role.
And what was that like for you when you first experienced his need for a very traditional woman?
Oh, I really began to rebel. Oh my God, you don't treat me this way. It's not my role in life. I was raised that way. I probably did what she had to do, or I'm going to do what I have to do, and I'm not. So it ended.
What happened?
Yes. And I have 4 children. Mm-hmm. 3 boys and a girl. And my oldest boy is granddaughter, mm-hmm. and then son, and daughter, and she's going to be 19 next week.
Does any of your children, do they live on the reservation?
No. They were all raised here in San Diego. We moved out here in 1961 when UCSC started.
Yeah. Did you experience any kind of discrimination? Because were interracial marriages where you were from, were they frowned upon?
Not really. No, I don't think so. And one of the things in an Indian community too, especially my community, which is matrilineal, children belong to the mother. Mm-hmm. So the children are all equal. Mm-hmm. And as far as the interracial marriage goes, there was not that stigma. Mm-hmm. And again, it's your choice. My father would have wished I'd made another choice. But that was my life story.
And when you moved here, did you find that that was different? Did you find that there was judgment about interracial marriage?
No. California is a very different part of the world, even in the 60s, you know. And especially in the academic world.
Okay.
Yeah. Because there were, professors of all various backgrounds.
Did you continue working when you left your teaching post at the reservation?
Yeah. I worked when we first got married into Chicago. Mm-hmm. We moved to Chicago, and I worked there, and then until I got pregnant with my first one. Mm-hmm. And then I did stay home. But I almost took classes. There, and again, that was my out. Mm-hmm. When I look back on my life, that was my out. I always went to school.
It was your relaxation.
Yes. Yeah. I think that was like coping mechanisms.
Was your husband supportive of that?
Yeah. He was in the beginning. He was really
supportive. So you've been in San Diego how long?
Since 1961.
June 1961. Mm-hmm. And what was it like being that far away from the reservation?
I was very lonely. I didn't want to come. When we came, I cried terribly. And that was fine for me. New Jersey was fine because I could get to my sisters, I could get to my father's, I did not want to come back to California. We'd been in California once. Mm-hmm. He did his PhD at Berkeley. So I experienced that, and then we moved back east. And I did not want to come back.
Was it the distance, or was it a lot of things?
It was a lot of things. It was the distance and just kind of leaving the family relationship, the family oriented. And that was hard. And then, after we'd been out here a few years, you've gotten a job offer at the University of Massachusetts at Amherst. I wanted to take it so badly. I even had called the movers. I was
ready to go.
I was ready to go. Let's go back. But it was very funny. After we divorced, he left and I stayed. Yeah, because I got very involved in the Indian community down here, and kind of loved it.
It sounds like you moved quite a bit in your early parts of your marriage.
Yes.
In each place that you moved, did you seek out a different Indian community?
Well, when we went to Chicago, there were a number of Indians from my grade. I had a cousin in Chicago. Okay. Yeah, so I knew people. And then I went home. Chicago was used to be. And then when we came to Berkeley, there were no Indians. There were Indians in Oakland. But many of them were Navajo and didn't really fit in with the Navajo. So we were only there for 3 years. And I had 2 small children.
Did you raise me predominantly in the white community?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
Was that very different for me?
Yeah, it was really hard for me. And I think that, we talk about it now. I really raised them, I guess, much more the way I was raised. Mm-hmm. And that was different. So, it hasn't hurt me.
Did they, what religion did you raise them with?
I didn't raise them with any.
Did you teach them about their...
Yeah. And when my father was alive, and the younger ones were, the older ones were, he used to sing to them. He used to say, I don't have enough knees for all my grandkids to sing Kaiowe.
That's one of those problems with too many grandkids.
Yeah.
Run out of knee space.
That's true. Right. That's right. So.
It sounds like you've always been very connected to your reservation.
I have. I have never left it in that sense. I've always come along.
When you entered into the world of the academic's wife, were there other women in that community that you could relate to at all?
No.
Did you socialize at all with them?
Yeah, we socialized, but again, school. You see, that's always been my escape. It has prevented me from really having to try and immerse myself into this world because I go to school and learn. I remember one time we went to a cocktail party. And one of the academic world used to be really weird years ago. The department chair's wife used to come calling me the contrary. Yes, when we were in Princeton. And I thought, what in the world are we into? Anyway, it wasn't like that at Berkeley. It was like that at Princeton. And then they tried to make it like that at UCSD, trying, because a lot of these professors came from these two schools. Mm-hmm. So we moved to San Diego in June. Before I was even settled in the house, I was over at San Diego State to find to go to school in the fall. And so I didn't go to anything. I had 3 small children. I was going to school full time, taking 9 units. So we go to this cocktail party and we say, oh, we have been sending you things all year long for our organization and you have never come. And I thought, I'm really telling. We're not going to go anywhere. I'm going to do it. I made one very, very good friend, and it was really funny. She and I are still really close. She's a Mexican woman, and we were the only two drunk in the whole. We all still laugh about it. We kind of went like this with each other, and she's still my girlfriend. And then as the school expanded, of course, and it became much more influential, they came here every time. And, I worked. And so with my kind of school.
When did you begin to focus your activities specifically on the Indian community? I don't know if there's even a defining moment.
I think there's a defining time. I think we became much more involved with the civil rights. When the civil rights started and the Indians started, and we were all involved. Before that, it was just kind of visiting, just kind of
maintaining
cultural friendships. But after that, then the activism started. Then that was the time.
I don't know, should we go on or should we save it?
We can save it. Okay. We can save it, yeah.